it's the pro-life establishment that is actually serving as the main obstacle in red majority states to the abolition of abortion. A few years back in Louisiana, I believe this was May of 2021, there was an abolition bill put forward in the Louisiana House. And from the discussions in the offices of House representatives, we had the votes to pass that bill. But then, unfortunately, the pro-life establishment stepped in, and a letter went out that was signed by 70 organizations nationwide from the pro-life movement, saying that they would not support a bill that would give equal justice and equal protection to the preborn. And so because of that, because of the influence of the pro-life lobby, then the bill was basically killed on the House floor in Louisiana. And we've seen some of those same dynamics play out in Ohio.
Today, we are joined by Nicholas Callis from End Abortion Ohio. This organization describes itself as being distinctively Christian and committed to working towards the legal abolition of abortion in Ohio. They believe that legislation should be consistent with the biblical standards of justice, morality, and righteousness. They believe bills that regulate murder and do not abolish it are dishonoring to God. Find out how the pro-life movement fights against the abortion abolitionists and why overturning Roe v. Wade wasn't the victory that anti-abortion advocates think it is. Nicholas will also discuss the Abolition of Abortion in Ohio Act that his organization is trying to get introduced this year. Stay tuned and find out why End Abortion Ohio believes you should love your preborn neighbor as yourself.
Okay. Yeah. Well, my organization is End Abortion Ohio. So we are a Christian organization that was founded in early 2022. So we've been around a couple years now, and we're a 501c4 organization. And so our mission is to abolish abortion unto the glory of God in the state of Ohio. And we're working towards that goal. We're going through the legislative process to do so. And we're seeking also to help the Christian church in Ohio to realize their responsibility to love their preborn neighbors as themselves and seek to establish justice for them. And so we do have a bill that would abolish abortion if it was passed. And we've been working with a few state representatives on that piece of legislation. Bradley Pierce, the president of Foundation to Abolish Abortion, and I believe the president of Abolish Abortion Texas, he wrote the bill for us. He's a U.S. Constitutional attorney, and he writes a lot of the abolition bills across the nation. And so we've had this bill for a couple years now, and just been taking it into the offices of legislators, senators and representatives in Ohio, trying to find a champion for the bill, somebody who's willing to carry it forward. And we believe that we're quite close to seeing the bill introduced. And so this bill, it's fairly short. It's only a page and a half in its entirety. And it's very simple. All it does is recognize that the preborn are persons made in the image of God. And it says that they should be given the same legal protections that you and I have as born persons. And so it doesn't really change any of the homicide code. All it does is apply the protections already given to persons, to the preborn in the homicide code.
So you say you've been shopping this bill around. I think most people would assume Republicans would jump at the chance to put their name on a abolition bill for abortion because they use it to fundraise all the time. Obviously, they're pro-life. And I'm a little bit familiar with the Abolition Rising organization. I don't know if you're technically joined with them or just have similar missions, but I know they complain that the pro-life movement does more damage than it does good to end abortion. So what's your experience of that here in Ohio? Like, is there a couple stories or something you know of about what you would think were pro-life people sabotaging you behind the scenes?
Yeah, we do have some stories about that, unfortunately. So just kind of backing up, we would distinguish ourselves from the pro-life establishment. So we would be part of the abolition movement that's really rising and spreading like wildfire across the nation. And what people are starting to realize is that it's the pro-life establishment that is actually serving as the main obstacle in red majority states to the abolition of abortion. A few years back in Louisiana, I believe this was May of 2021, there was an abolition bill put forward in the Louisiana House. And from the discussions in the offices of House representatives, we had the votes to pass that bill. But then, unfortunately, the pro-life establishment stepped in and a letter went out that was signed by 70 organizations nationwide from the pro-life movement saying that they would not support a bill that would give equal justice and equal protection to the preborn. And so because of that, because of the influence of the pro-life lobby, then the bill was basically killed on the House floor in Louisiana. And we've seen some of those same dynamics play out in Ohio. So when we got started as an organization, it was also the same time when the news about Issue 1 started to come out. And so Issue 1 was the constitutional amendment that was approved here last November in the state of Ohio that basically allows abortion up all through all 9 months in the pregnancy. Issue 1 made abortion a constitutional right in our state constitution here in Ohio. And so when we started to lobby and bring our abolition bill into the offices of legislators, news about Issue 1 began to break. And most of the Republican legislators took the position that it wasn't the time to press this sort of legislation because they thought it would play right into the hands of the left in their efforts to establish abortion as a constitutional right. However, we did have a few legislators who were willing to carry the bill forward. At the same time, we were talking to pro-life organizations in the state and introducing this piece of legislation to them and asking them to sign on to it and kind of pull their support and put their resources behind the bill, as this was, you know, an opportunity to abolish abortion now that Roe v. Wade was overturned. However, what we found was stiff resistance. A lot of the resistance came due to ideological differences, but also because of timing. And so we were about to introduce the bill in September of 2023 when the head of a prominent pro-life Christian organization in Ohio actually lobbied against our bill and helped persuade our bill sponsor not to introduce the bill. And so we've definitely seen those type of dynamics in Ohio, and we've labored very hard to try to extend an olive branch to the pro-life organizations and try to convince them that this bill is what is necessary to undo the disastrous effects of Issue 1. But unfortunately, many of these organizations, they're ideologically opposed to the bill and haven't lended their support to it and likely will not.
What is the reason that they give that they're ideologically don't support something that's against abortion, especially when they're a Christian organization? Do they actually put the line of human life like 2 or 3 months or something? What's the reason they give? Because that's so hard to wrap your head around. I grew up going to Southern Baptist churches, and yeah, so it was always like big no-no to have an abortion. But then most of the people I knew, girls, got all sorts of abortions. And then we hear about this on the pro-life movement. What do they say, or do they not really have an answer other than they might lose donors? Is it just a business now?
Well, that's definitely one of the concerns. You know, a lot of these heads of these pro-life organizations are making a lot of money from the work that they're doing. And, you know, essentially they're making profit off the Christian church. And so if abortion were to be ended, then their profit would be ended as well. And so, you know, I think that money is probably a motivation for a lot of these individuals. However, there's also this thing called the second victim narrative. And so a lot of these pro-life organizations believe that the woman is also the second victim in an abortion. And that because she is the second victim, that she should not be held legally responsible for her actions in an abortion. So what our bill does, all it does is apply the same laws that protect you and I as born persons to the preborn. It just applies the protections in the homicide code to the preborn. And so what would happen then if, you know, a woman were to be found guilty of obtaining abortion, then she would be subject to prosecution. And so because these pro-life organizations have a prior commitment to this narrative that the woman is the second victim, then they don't want to see this bill implemented, because then a guilty mother would be subject to prosecution, which they're opposed to.
Do you think if the bill gets proposed and let's say it passes, do you think the governor is going to sign the bill? I assume then you would also have a fight, because we do have the amendment to the Constitution from 2023. Do y'all have lawyers on standby to fight this all the way to the top of the state Supreme Court? Like, what's the following game plan after the bill's passed?
Yeah, it's likely that the governor would not support this piece of legislation. You know, he's a bit of a rhino in some regards. And we've tried to talk to him before about this. Not just us, but other organizations that are like-minded as well. And I don't think he would really support anything more than the 6-week ban. And so that's kind of his limit. And now with the constitutional amendment in place, I don't think he sees any role for this kind of legislation in the state. But if this were to pass, then we would definitely fight this throughout the judicial system and hopefully take it, if not to the Ohio Supreme Court, or not just to the Ohio Supreme Court, but also the U.S. Supreme Court. So we do have legal personnel on standby waiting to argue this bill.
Okay, now the governor is going to be coming up on term limits soon, so we'll be getting a new governor in Ohio. Do you think maybe the right-wing movement in this country with MAGA and everything has changed enough that if you introduce the bill again under a new conservative governor, someone like Vivek Ramaswamy, he keeps flirting with the idea of running. Do you think that would be more plausible to get the bill passed? Or do you think that is still part of the pro-life movement that doesn't want to see a bill like this passed?
It's definitely still the heart of the pro-life movement to oppose these kind of bills. However, the window for this kind of work and our ideology that we're trying to teach is definitely shifting in, I think, our direction. And we're seeing more and more people exposed to the corruption of the pro-life movement. And more people are leaving the pro-life movement. We have a hashtag called Plexit. So exiting the pro-life movement. And a lot of people are seeing the, they're seeing the abolition movement and how it's more representative of their beliefs, and how it's more consistent to the pro-life confession that life begins at fertilization. And so I do think over time, you're going to see the pro-life movement play less of a role. However, I'll give you an example. An abolition bill was just introduced in North Dakota, and it had some hearings. And there were still many pro-life organizations that lobbied against that bill. And there was also another letter sent to the House of Representatives in North Dakota, I believe in the spring of 2024, when this bill was first introduced. And it was similar to the letter that was sent out in May of 2021 by the pro-life organizations in the state of Louisiana. And essentially the bill again, or the letter again, reiterates that the pro-life movement does not stand for the abolition bills, because it would subject women to prosecution. And that letter that was sent out in 2024 to the House of Representatives in North Dakota was signed by major pro-life organizations such as Students for Life and the March for Life too. And so this is still very much a division between the pro-life movement and the abolition movement, although we are seeing it start to shift more towards the abolition movement. I hope so. But yeah, you know, it's interesting you talk about MAGMA and the sort of window of opportunity that presents to conservatives in the nation. And I think a window of opportunity is a good way to express it. We do see individuals and organizations on the right becoming more bold and emboldened to press conservative values in the legislative sphere. And so, you know, I am hoping that Republicans who maybe are ideologically aligned with us, but haven't found the courage to necessarily come out and join our efforts, would kind of see this as an opportunity to really press hard while we have more conservative people in positions of power.
Now, you mentioned a couple of times about criminal prosecutions for the woman if she'd have an abortion, because that would be part of applying the homicide code. What degree of murder would the woman be charged with? Would it be like first degree murder or a lower level of murder? What, I'm curious how that's viewed according to the abolition movement.
Well, so we wouldn't change anything about the process of the justice system. Due process would remain intact. So, you know, what degree of murder, that would be handled case by case in the judicial system. So this would just be treated as any other case of homicide.
Okay, so up to the prosecutor to decide then how to charge the abortion. Right. Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't specify a certain degree in the bill.
Okay. Now, like I mentioned earlier, yesterday I interviewed Dr. Anita Samani, and she's got this controversial bill she proposed. Conception begins at erection. I wish I could church that up a little bit and make it cleaner. Sorry to speak like that, but that's what it's actually called. And so she makes the case that if we're going to restrict women's rights, then we might as well restrict men's rights in the same way. So you can't release genetic material without the intent to have a baby. And so I was just kind of wondering, what is y'all's organization, like, official response to that bill? Because it's kind of controversial and it's very jarring.
Yeah. Well, we've come out and said that it's definitely a waste of state resources to waste time, you know, proposing this bill that is, quite frankly, a joke, and that's not going to go anywhere. But I think she's trying to frame the issue in a certain way, but the way that she's framing the issue is erroneous. You know, she's saying that anti-abortion advocates are trying to limit a woman's right. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to protect the innocent party in an abortion, which is the preborn. And so we're saying, look, you don't have a right to use your body in such a way that would harm an innocent person. Our rights end to act, you know, our freedom to act in a certain way ends when the rights of another individual begin. And so she's wanting to frame our activism as contrary to women's rights, where we're saying, no, we're actually trying to secure the rights of preborn individuals who are made in God's image.
Well, when I spoke to her, I read a quote from Austin that was in an article I'd read about this whole discussion. And what I read to her was, he said, the pro-life movement has never tried to regulate women's bodies. We're trying to regulate the actions of people who want to kill another person. And I said, what's your response to that? And she said,
that is just fancy linguistics, right? That's not reality. A six-week fetus cannot survive outside the uterus.
So what would you say to that? I'd just like to get kind of point for point.
Yeah. Well, just because a six-week fetus can't survive outside of the uterus at this point does not mean that they're not a person. That's nonsensical. That doesn't change what the fetus is ontologically. Doesn't change what they are in terms of their being. they are a member of the human species, and thus they are a person. We cannot separate personhood from humanity, and if we do, then we're always going to subject a class of humans to improper treatment under the law.
Now, I do want to ask you, you probably get these questions a lot, but a couple of exceptions that people like to bring up to try to make it look like the abolitionist movement isn't a good idea. What do you say to someone that says, hey, if a girl's raped or it's incest, we should let her have an abortion because that's such a tragic circumstance? How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, rape and incest are certainly tragic circumstances. We would for sure mourn with the individual who was victimized in that situation. However, abortion is also a tragic situation. The murder of an innocent human being does not make right the wrong that was done. And so we don't believe that the child should die for the sins of their father. That's still an innocent child that should be given legal protections, the same legal protections that you and I have as well. And so we think that to allow abortion in the case of rape and incest would be a grave and greater injustice.
And what do you say when people bring up the fact the life of the mother is a consideration? Maybe they need to have an abortion because the mother would die in childbirth. How is that handled?
Well, I want to read from the Dublin Declaration on Maternal Health Care. This is a declaration that was signed by over 1,000 medical professionals, including OBGYNs, pediatrics, and even some medical students. And what the declaration says, it's quite simple, but it says, as experienced practitioners and researchers and obstetricians and gynecology, we affirm that direct abortion, the purposeful destruction of the unborn child, is not medically necessary to save the life of a woman. We uphold that there is a fundamental difference between abortion and necessary medical treatments that are carried out to save the life of the mother, even if such treatment results in the loss of life of her unborn child. And they say, we confirm that the prohibition of abortion does not affect in any way the availability of optimal care to pregnant women. So we would hold to the Dublin Declaration of Maternal Health Care. And I think that distinction they make, where they say, we uphold that there's a fundamental difference between abortion and necessary medical treatments that are carried out to save the life of the mother, though they may result in the loss of life to the unborn child, is crucial. So abortion is the intentional destruction of innocent human life. And there are, you know, situations such as an ectopic pregnancy where we don't necessarily have the available medical technology all the time to save the embryo that has implanted in the outside of the fallopian tube. So we need to do a procedure that would be an intervention to save the life of the mother, but that unfortunately would likely result in the death of the embryo. But that's different from a direct abortion, which is the intentional destruction of innocent human life. And our bill makes that distinction as well. At the end, we do specify that nothing in the bill would apply to the unintentional death of an unborn child when such death results from the undertaking of life-saving procedures on a pregnant woman, when such procedures are accompanied by reasonable steps, if available, to save the life of her unborn child.
Now, given that y'all are distinctly Christian organization, like, you make no bones about it that you do this because you believe the Bible condemns abortion, has that ever become like a stumbling block, you think, to getting bills passed? Because people say, oh, we got to leave church and state separate. Do you think it holds back the abolitionist movement? Or does it actually maybe boost it in some way we can't think of and people are more receptive to it? It seems like we live in such an immoral time. Like, You can just look at the current administration and they have kids willy-nilly. There's not a lot of morality left in this country. I could just imagine right. like a group of Christians coming in with an abolition bill and people get turned off because of religion. Do you encounter that part or no?
No, we do. I mean, it certainly is a stumbling block for some people and certain legislators, especially on the Democratic side of the aisle, of course. But we do think that this Christian, this distinctively biblical idea that everyone is made in the image of God is the only thing that can give transcendent value to human beings. And so the proclamation that we are all, no matter our size or gender or ethnicity, are made in God's image, speaks volumes. And it sets up this idea that our rights as individuals are not given to us by the state, and thus cannot be taken away by the state. Rather, they're given to us by a transcendent God, and thus they should be secured and protected by the state. And so I think our Christian position actually enables us to stand on solid ground while arguing for the protection of all individuals.
Now, something else that I know the abolitionist movement gets accused of is it's a racist term to use the word abolitionist because it links back to slavery. What is the reason y'all use that word? I know there's some connection between saying people who opposed abolition now for babies would probably oppose abolition of slavery in the past. Could you kind of make that argument to people that have not really heard that before?
Yeah. Well, I think abolitionist is simply a term to describe a way or a method to eradicate great evils. And so it is historically tied in our understanding to the abolition of slavery in the West. However, it's not so inextricably tied to that it can't be separated from that. So we understand it to be a method of how to eradicate great evil from our society. And so the abolition movement is based on this idea that there is a higher law than man's law, and that law it's God's law, and that the state has the responsibility to do what is right in God's eyes when it legislates, and that we are not able to tolerate injustices such as slavery or abortion. And so, you know, we want to abolish it legally and not give it any room to flourish or grow.
I wanted to ask you about Roe v. Wade getting overturned, because yeah. I think most people would assume that's a good thing for pro-life movement or people who don't like abortion. But I know abolitionists have kind of made the case that it wasn't necessarily great. If you could flesh that out, because that was a whole new concept to me, that overturning that wasn't necessarily a good thing for the yeah. abolitionist movement. Just kind of unpack it.
Yeah, well, before Roe v. Wade was overturned, we were still arguing essentially the same strategy that we're arguing now, that there is a higher law that supersedes the laws of men, and that is the law of God. And so our state legislators, although they were kind of, you know, technically under the I'll say this. State legislators thought that they had to, you know, abide by Roe v. Wade because it was the higher law of the land. But we were essentially arguing the principle of nullification, and this idea of the lesser magistrate, that the lesser magistrate has a responsibility to abide by the higher law, which is the law of God, and to establish justice and to defy Roe v. Wade. And so we didn't think the overturning of Roe v. Wade was actually necessary to abolish abortion, though in a lot of states, certainly, you know, I think is proving helpful. It's taking away that stumbling block that was in the way of a lot of legislators. However, we do, as an organization, say that we shouldn't celebrate the overturning of Roe v. Wade. We can certainly be glad that it's gone, like that Roe and Casey are no longer in play. And we can celebrate, you know, the correction of several errors that Roe and Casey were founded upon. But we're very careful not to celebrate the means by which they were done away with, namely the Dobbs v. Jackson decision. And so essentially what the Dobbs v. Jackson decision did was it returned the right to regulate and prohibit abortion back to the states. And we think that the court made an error in returning that decision back to the states, because we believe that the preborn should be protected under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. And so essentially the U.S. Supreme Court did what Pontius Pilate did at his decision. He kind of washed his hands, and he tried to wash his hands of the blood of Christ. And that's what essentially the U.S. Supreme Court tried to do by returning it back to the states. They tried to say that this is out of our jurisdiction, whereas actually, I think what they should have done is they should have ruled that abortion is unconstitutional per the 14th Amendment, and ruled that states don't have a right to abortion, as it's unconstitutional. So that would be kind of our understanding of the legal framework of Roe, Casey, Dobbs, and Jackson. And, you know, it's actually Dobbs v. Jackson in some ways has had disastrous consequences, you know, most notably enabling the surge of state-by-state ballot initiatives, especially as we've seen here in Ohio, where now we're making a much harder argument in some ways than we were before Roe v. Wade was overturned, because now it's in our state constitution, which is a different animal. You know, talking about overturning that is a different animal than talking about nullifying a judicial ruling at the federal level.
I wanted to ask you kind of more of a macro level question about abortion. A couple years ago, presidential debate, there was a question about abortion brought up, and Vivek Ramaswamy, he gave an answer that I thought was interesting.
And also, here's the missing ingredient in this movement: sexual responsibility for men. We live in an era of reliable genetic paternity tests that are 100% reliable. So we can say men deserve more responsibility. So we can tell women, we're all in this together. It's not men's rights versus women's rights. It's about human rights. And I come back to that case that Clarence Thomas spoke of. A pregnant woman walking down the street, she's assaulted. The unborn child dies in that assault. You find me one person in this country who says that that criminal does not deserve liability for that death. You won't find one. That says we share the same instincts on this issue, but we require, I believe, a different generation of leadership,
thank you,
to actually lead us forward and unite the country on this.
Thank you.
Honesty.
Thank you, Mr. Ramaswamy.
So I was wondering, does the abolition movement feel like there should be some sort of legislation in addition to the anti-abortion stuff that demands more responsibility for their part in creating children? Because a lot of times these women are pregnant, and the reason they want the abortion is the men will just bounce. And it's a financial responsibility. It's an emotional responsibility, a time commitment. In what ways do you think there should be laws to demand responsibility from men?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if we have an official position on an organization. I'm sure within our board there are differences of opinions on that specifically. However, you know, I will say again that we want abortion to be treated just in any other way that homicide would be treated. So, for example, if the man in the situation was responsible in any way for this homicide, then he would also be subject to prosecution. But, you know, broadly, I think many in our movement would be against no-fault divorce, things of that nature that, as you're, I think, pointing out, you know, lessen the responsibility of men and what they do with their sexuality, which, as we've seen, that sort of loosening of the morality in our culture has caused devastating consequences resulting from our unbridled sexual freedom.
I guess the last thing I want to ask you is, what made you get so involved in this abolition movement? Because when abortion's brought up, it's always described as a women's issue, but obviously men are fathers, it's half their kid. What inspired you to get involved in this? Because there are a lot of men in the pro-life movement. It's kind of like shocking how many men are against it.
Yeah. Well, ever since I knew what abortion was, at least earliest I can remember, I've always been opposed to it. I remember getting into arguments with my history teacher at school about it. But I think what's helped solidify my commitment against abortion was seeing abortion. And you will hear this from a lot of pro-life and anti-abortion abolitionist activists who have committed their time and their energy to fighting this great injustice, is that they've seen abortion face to face. They've either seen it in a picture or in a video. And once you see it, it takes the issue out of the realm of abstract and out of the realm of conceptual ideas, and puts it into the grisly, horrific reality that it is. So now that I've seen abortion like face to face, I can't tell my conscience no and not do something about this horrific evil. And more than that, the word of God telling me to love my neighbor as myself and to do justice to the fatherless and love the afflicted binds my conscience to pursue justice for the preborn and do everything that is within my power and my ability to fight for them.
To find out more about this organization, go to endabortionohio.com. Follow them on Twitter or on Facebook. And if you would like to get the other side of the abortion debate, then check out my interview with Representative Dr. Anita Samani, who's proposed the bill Conception Begins at Erection. Now that you know where we've been, find out where we're going. Tune in to Ladies Love Politics, where you can stay informed without going insane.